I'm from Colorado State, and I named this presentation before I knew about Anyo being on the panel. So I did include a little bit on dairy as well. In Colorado, beef is kind of king, so most of what I'm talking about that we've done, at least, is beef-oriented, but I have some great colleagues out there in the ag economics field. I drew some of their research into this as well to try to be inclusive. Us economists do think of ourselves as scientists, so I'll pick on Chris a little bit. But it is definitely a different orientation of science, and what I would say is that even part of what I'm looking at won't look like it's as tight to grass-fed as you might think, but because the consumer marketplace is so complex, I'm really also going to look at some of the complementarities where some of the grass-fed issues are overlapping and interacting with other claims that consumers are looking at in the marketplace, because that is the reality of how consumers are making choices. So what are the economics of grass-fed? Well, most of my personal work has been on the demand side and looking at how consumers behave and looking a little bit about their perceptions and values and how that might affect what they're doing in the marketplace. But we've also done a little bit on production practices and costs, mostly in case studies, nothing nearly as complete or system-oriented as the ladies that preceded me, but can definitely talk about what our field is starting to see in the realm of production practices. And then looking a little bit at the complexity of the marketplace, where the USDA enters, where certifications enter, and the realities of what it actually looks like when a consumer is making a choice. So what spurred our very first work in this almost a decade ago was the growing demand producers were getting and hearing about for naturally and minimal processed meats without antibiotics and hormones. We quickly assessed that grass-fed and humane treatment of animals were also interlinked within some of those values. So what we first did, working with a group called Colorado Homestead Meats on the West Slope of Colorado, is to start looking at customers not as average, which is what the commodity markets do, but instead looking at how we segment customers and look for the particular sets of customers who are interested in this and what's driving their demand. So to do that, we do things called factor analysis and clustering. We started out with factor analysis. And what we look at there is not what's the same about consumers, because that puts you in the average marketplace. We looked at what things explain the most variability across choices that consumers were making. And we did find the thing that explains the most variability is concern about production practices, and that includes hormones, antibiotics, grass-fed, and humane treatment of animals. The second thing was their willingness to pay, so that's price sensitivity, which most people think is the biggest difference among people, and it was not, but it was definitely high. Then the meat attributes, whether it was a brand name, whether it was fresh versus frozen, whether it was pre-seasoned or easy, those convenience products that are coming out in the meat sector. And then we looked at some of the reasons that were motivating them to pay more for local natural products. Specifically, what we did is after they gave a premium they were willing to pay, we said, what are you attributing that premium to? Is it that you think you're helping producers, that you think you're helping the environment, that you think you're helping the community, or you think you're benefiting your health? And those things were all very important as well. And this was a nationwide survey, even though it was done by us at CSU. So what we found is that the highest factor was basically these public-minded, civically motivated consumers who were looking for alternative production practices, not just for their own health benefits, but also because they were trying to help their communities and the set of local producers that they shopped with. That doesn't mean that's 60% of all consumers. It means the highest variability across people were people who highlighted themselves by that. So it's basically looking for the outliers. And we tell the producers this is the consumers they want to find. Most of them are not big enough to serve the full retail market. They want to look for pockets of people they want to sell to. There were some people also worried about the public health concerns, particularly with antibiotics. But you'll notice the personal needs didn't dominate here, not because they're not important, but because everybody has those concerns, and that does include health. So when this was all done, what we did is we grouped these people into consumer segments. Quickly here you can see how we named them. We named them based on things that were different about them. And this was important because basically what we do with producers then is we have them target sets of consumers that are well aligned to what they might want to do. And given the discussion we heard this morning, I can guarantee you the highest target market for grass-fed is probably the health-conscious urban parents. And you'll see not only because they're worried about these things, but you'll notice they also have a higher willingness to pay and maybe shopping in locales that it's more likely some of your grass-fed producers have the ability to get into without being large and well linked into the supply chain by themselves independently. So the quality seekers and health and natural consumers are both willing to pay for that natural local beef. The quality seekers kind of just expect quality. These are your Whole Foods shoppers. They just want things to look pretty. The problem with them and some of your producers who you're going to be talking with is that very likely they're going to have frozen product if they don't have a retail outlet that they directly work with. Those quality seekers seem to be less tolerant of that kind of product. Whereas the health and natural consumers who are more altruistic and know that they might have to make alternatives in their lifestyle to meet the needs of the product they want to get, they're the ones really worried about production attributes. At the time of this study in 2002, grass-fed was not ranking high. We have not replicated this study. We'll probably be doing it sometime in the next year or two. But they were worried a lot about things that weren't what we consider naturally personal benefits like price and eating quality. They were worried more about production attributes. This is a very busy chart. So to save you a headache, what you want to look for is the taller bars. These are people who shop and where they shop at different locations. Mostly what I want to highlight here is that some of our target markets, namely the dark burgundy bars, the health-conscious urban parents, are those people more likely to be shopping at some alternative markets and not needing to be found at supermarkets, health natural food stores, retail, meat shops, farmers markets, and direct from producers. As I said, marketing isn't just about prices. It's about how you're going to get through the food supply chain to actually sell to consumers. Supermarkets are not going to be very realistic options for most grass-fed producers, both because of the need for high-volume, fresh product year-round, and because of the fact most of them don't have the volume they would want, whereas some of these alternative markets are places that not only they could carry enough volume and the right product mix for, but that where the particular customers they're likely to be attractive to shop. So you have to remember, the marketing problem isn't just about price, it's about getting to the right sets of customers who are interested in your product. Still, it is clear that large food retailers are the primary access point for meat purchases. What you kind of have to just, again, realize and communicate with producers you might be working with is that there's barriers of entry for grass-fed producers in those venues, both because of volume, handling requirements, seasonality, and maybe even just the processing capacity in your region. So these specialty food stores or now restaurants may be the more flexible options. But as I said, the good news is the people most aligned with the values that would want to buy grass-fed beef are already looking at those venues as where they shop anyway. So it's kind of good news, and it may feel less like a barrier and a constraint to producers you might be working with. Another thing I wanted to highlight, because this is pretty recent, now in the Ag Census, they actually do look at data like what producers are selling direct to consumers. That is another option that was already mentioned this morning for grass-fed. What this map shows is in color of intensity where we already see a lot of direct sales happening in the country. And the good news is there are a lot of dark colors. There's a lot of places where we see significant direct sales happening. That tells us as economists that there's actually both supply and demand and they're finding themselves in the marketplace. The problem is if you're in the middle region of the country, it looks a little less promising. Let me highlight two things, though. First of all, the coast are the most year-round food production areas in the country, so it's going to be easier for them to have higher volumes of direct sales. And the fact that you do see some pockets in the, I can almost point to some of those pockets in the the middle land. And it's not necessarily that they're particularly high population areas, but they're because you see some pockets of more entrepreneurial, value-added producers, generally because they found ways to ally with each other. You see very few success stories where you see producers doing this on their own, especially meat producers. So what you actually are really seeing is pockets where you see some interesting energy going on, and that pocket on the west side of Colorado there is this group that I was working on 10 years ago, and that's because five producer rancher families found each other. Virginia didn't show up like I was hoping it was going to for you guys, but I know there's a lot of interesting things going on there as well. This is another busy chart, but it was meant to show you kind of comparatively how grass-fed does. These are those same clusters of individuals. So partly what you're looking for is the height of the bars for importance to consumers, but also variability across the colored bars for how differently different types of consumers look at things. So grass-fed does well, but it was at this point not stacking up quite as important as antibiotics and hormones. We have to remember this was 10 years ago. Hormones and antibiotics have gotten so much press, almost the market really has become saturated. There is a lot of product offerings now that don't have hormones and antibiotics defined slightly different ways. But I think what you're seeing now is that the next wave of interest is about grass-fed and humane certification or humane treatment of animals. But you'll also see again that target market of health-conscious urban parents. The burgundy bar, the group we think is very, very viable as a customer base, they had strong interest in this even as far back as 10 years ago, and they are willing to pay for it. These are just some of the other attributes we asked about, mostly to show you this was right after one of the BSE scares that we had, and so BSE testing, even though it didn't exist, ranked very high. That's to highlight that consumers are very easily swayed, very trendy, and slightly hard to track. Unlike the animals we heard about this morning earlier, who always behave about the same way, consumers, I can't say that about at all. So we have to kind of keep going and retesting them to look at their barometer. But you will notice as well, humane treatment was ranking high even back at this time too. The reason I keep highlighting that is whether it's true or not, there's a strong belief among consumers that grass-fed pasture systems are more humane than grain systems. I'm not saying it's true, I'm saying what the perception is and what people value, so it's important to track that as well. So looking at some of the other research that's been done out there that I wanted to draw from is there is a Leopold Center at Iowa State University where I'm an alum that has looked a little bit at grass-fed systems as well. And what they really found, and it's kind of aligned with what we see on the consumer side, is that most grass-fed production systems are being led by producers who are motivated with aligning their production systems with their own values. And that was 86% of them. It was not a profit motive. And also to the resources of their farms and ranches. The fact they may just have good forage systems, or they are particularly good managers of forage systems, and they might find it attractive to go back to systems that use their comparative advantage. They also saw the increase in available markets and a potential for increased profits to be important drivers to why you see people moving to grass-fed as well. If you actually look at, and we're going to look at this a little more deeply, most natural beef programs that they analyzed exceeded the USDA definition. The problem us economists see is when you have producers exceeding USDA standards or definitions, or as Susan alluded to, I would never say anything bad about USDA myself, but I'll allude to Susan saying the USDA standards sometimes are not aligned with the science. That creates a problem for producers because when they're operating in a marketplace that has consumers trained to look for signals that either they're exceeding or that they're not aligned with because they're trying to follow science, it creates an information problem for them. So marketing becomes very important, but marketing is very costly too. When you can't abide by the USDA standards because they don't fit you well, it's costly to go in direct market, although there's some evidence that there's pretty good price benefits in some markets in the country. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how this aligns with organic, for instance. Organic is the one standard out there that has kind of made some advances in getting established in the marketplace. So what you see is you often see grass-fed and organic aligning. Not necessarily because there's total production complementarities, there's some, but because in the marketplace, it's a better anchor to be organic than grass-fed because there's been more groundwork done to establish that in the supply chain. So what their study looked at is basically that what you guys do is what they need. They need, the training needs to be on management intensive grazing systems that a lot of producers had grown a generation from learning about either from their own family or from their universities. And so the best chances for profitability for organic grain-fed operations will be where they produce their grains and don't pay market value. And I don't know what got cut off there. So whether it's grass-fed purely or grass-fed with grain finish, what we're seeing in most of the production studies is that that is only going to be financially viable if it's self-contained within the own operation, because the markets are such that having to buy some of that in and compete for other uses of it, such as in the West, organic dairy, is problematic. So we did do a few case studies at CSU's South San Luis Valley area to look at some cow-calf operations, and they, neither of them was large, but they were typical of that particular region, which is a very limited resource region of our state. And what we found is that although size did matter a little bit in their total operating expenses, and again, notice we don't have the overhead and land expenses because those are a little harder to tease out of people, except for where they're paying a direct pasture rent. But we found a price differential between the two sizes where the 50-head operation had $368 in operating expenses, whereas the 87-head was only $237 a head. But the bigger issue here wasn't about their size, it was about whether they had their own grass or not. And that kind of is meant to reinforce what we just saw from the Iowa State Leopold Center study, that it's really about whether you self-contain the pasturing within an operation or not, how cost competitive they can be. What we found in those case studies as well is that most producers understood what we call technical efficiency of running those operations, where they should be on rate of gain and so forth, but they didn't understand what the impacts on their operations of both size or scale efficiency, economists call that, or the complementary activities of producing your own grazing system was versus having to buy that in. And as we saw this morning, that was only reinforced more in the fact that if you're buying it in, you might lose some of the nutritional properties as well. So that led us to talk about the fact that what we see really happening in the marketplace is a look at what some of the other certifications are that are complementary to grass-fed. It's very challenging for me to see from what I've seen in the marketplace how grass-fed producers are going to do very much beyond direct sales in their community marketplace without either adding an additional certification that maybe has a little more marketing muscle behind it, or that more consumers are looking for, and really it's almost like a bundling of certifications. So some of them I'm going to look at this morning because I see them working for some people are the ones listed here. Organic is what we have the most data on, and this is an interesting map that the Economic Research Service put together. The bigger the circle there, the larger the amount of organic certified land is in that state. And then within that circle, you have the part that is pasture and range versus the percentage that is cropland. The darker color is cropland, the lighter green is pasture. And the 10 states that are the largest states actually are denoted there and have writing in them, whereas the other ones are smaller, although there's quite a few states that are small, but not that small. But what you're going to see, and especially in my region of the country, is that there is a lot of organic pasture land coming online, mostly because it was pretty easy to put online relative to taking cropland through the certification process. And although dairy probably drove a lot of that, we're seeing a lot more interest in range systems for beef, and even as strong as the lamb market is now, sheep as well. But this is what's going on with organic dynamics, and as you can see, it's significant in growing, and particularly growing in what would be pasture systems, although some of that is pretty marginal. The Economic Research Service also did an oversampling of organic dairies about 5 years ago, and it's just now being reported. And this is our first glimpse into a bigger set of production economics than what I could present from our couple of case studies. And what they did find is that organic dairies were producing less milk per cow, and we'll get back to how this relates to grass-fed here in a bit. And part of that was because of scale efficiency. They're just smaller dairies on average. They look pretty big compared to the Netherlands, I guess, but they're small for US standards. But they also are using a significantly more pasture-based feeding systems. So what's hard to decouple there then is how much of that production efficiency loss is because of size, how much is because of organic practices that don't allow for some use of some inputs, and how much is because of pasture versus grain-based feeding. Probably all three matter. What they didn't quite disentangle here yet is what percentage is which, but we'll look at it. But the Northeast and the small herds were particularly high in use of grass-fed systems. And that whole report is available for you to look at. It's a very rich report if you're working with dairy at all. And I would say any of you working with other species, such as beef, could also probably get some insights into what this is probably going to look like for other livestock systems as well. For organic dairies, they were paying quite a bit more in operating and capital cost, including those certification transition costs as of 2005. So on average, they were paying $7.65 per hundredweight higher than for conventional. But again, what they haven't disentangled in this study yet is what percentage of that is based on different things that are different. Once again, whether they're small, whether they're pasture-based, and then those other organic inputs they're limited from using. However, at that time, the average price premium for organic milk was only $6.69 higher. So that is not the economics we want to see. It shows that there's actually, at this point in time, a loss from those inefficiencies because the premium wasn't high enough. Now, what we've seen since the time of the study is even if organic is still not the most profitable notion, it's definitely been a more stable notion. And so we've seen resiliency in this sector pretty well throughout the U.S. This is just a synopsis of organic farmland acreage. Again, this doesn't talk specifically about grass-fed systems, but given there seems to be such a linkage between the two, it's interesting to note the significant triple-digit, sometimes quadruple-digit growth we're seeing in organic animal systems, and they were definitely late to come on. We saw fresh produce dominate the sector, but it's clear that if you're working in livestock systems and grass-fed systems, probably organic is something you also need to be considering, both when making your recommendations and designing your research. So let's look at some of the certification programs that you will probably need to understand and interact with if you're working with people looking at grass-fed. The American Grass-Fed Association, which is actually located in Colorado, chose to go a different route than what we're seeing here this morning. There was some interest in trying to get them to think stronger, more strongly about some actual meat attributes within their certification. Instead, they kind of went the humane certification route. They partnered with the Food Alliance out of Oregon, and any rancher who uses this label both has to abide by American Grass-Fed and Food Alliance standards. If you don't know Food Alliance, it's a fair trade organization, which there's also a lot of consumer interest in. It's about how workers are treated, the environment's treated, the farmers' returns are determined, but it's very, very, a very different direction than what we heard this morning about some of the best attributes that you could probably market are nutritionally based. They did not go that direction at all. They do have fairly strict standards on what percentage of the diet is forage, went along with the organic notions of no antibiotics or hormones, and it does address animal welfare again. There is actually an animal welfare approved designation out there as well, run by the Animal Welfare Institute. Again, this might seem far afield of our topic this morning, except for the fact that, like I said, and was alluded to this morning, there's a lot of beliefs among consumers that grass-fed already is humane treatment. And so for some of your people looking for all the different ways they can market themselves, they may want to consider bundling their grass-fed claim along with an animal welfare claim as well, particularly the no closed confinement and ability to socialize and party, which I guess a lot of animals need to do, go along very well with some of the production methods you can imagine coming out of a forage-based systems. There's actually another one then called Certified Humane, Raised and Handled. It's run by an organization that is also a nonprofit. I cut off some words there with the logo, sorry. But again, it goes along very well with a grass-fed system. In this case, that is a USDA verification program. Those are taking hold, particularly with some of our big retailers. Costco, I think, is one organization I know of some producers working with that is very much aligned with this type of certification rather than production systems. This is actually probably more important to them now than organic. So again, it's something to have your producers at least research whether their grass-fed system goes along with another certification program. Just to show you that I'm only giving you the tip of the iceberg, there is a whole system of certifications out there. Not all of them are relevant for livestock, but there's definitely a lot out there, and that should be the first piece of homework you give any of the producers you work with. And quite honestly, as you develop your research designs, if you're looking to do research in this realm, can you add one of these certifications guidelines to your design and look at whether it does make a difference for nutrition issues or environmental issues or animal health issues, because they're very real marketing claims and certifications that are being used in the marketplace. And as economists like to believe, if it's in the marketplace, there has been a revealed value from consumers or retailers or restaurants about using them. This is just the same diagram, but to just show you it a little more matrix space. The left-hand side is the name of the certification program. The top is what kind of issues they address with that certification program, and the right-hand side is whether it's relevant for livestock, crops, or both. So it's a little easier for you to see what things are addressed in those. Grass-fed does not show up in here, but the characteristics of it definitely show up a little bit in organic production, animal welfare, and ecologically sustainable criteria that they put within those certifications. So connecting to the marketplace, again, it was brought up this morning, none of this does a producer much good unless they figure out how they're going to get their product with its specific benefits to the marketplace. What we're seeing evolve is these new values-based supply chains that I think is going to get talked about here in a little bit, about how we actually retrofit the system to handle these new products. Some examples I challenge you to go look at are Oklahoma Food Co-op and La Montanita. You actually see groups now where consumers are becoming members of co-ops because they want to support the supply chain development that gets local product to them in a convenient manner and don't want it to be just at farmers markets or through buying a quarter of a cow freezer beef every fall. Another instrument that's coming online, you should all investigate if you haven't already, is Market Maker. It's in 18 states now. Colorado just came online. It's a place not only for your producers to get online and promote what they're doing if they're trying to sell, but if you're all looking for producer partners to work with on your projects, it's basically the best online database, if it happens to be in your state, to find producers who are calling themselves grass-fed, and I'll show you what it looks like here in a bit. And then obviously there's a lot of producer associations local food councils and slow food groups throughout the country, who all of those seem to have a lot of grasp and interest in them as well. So this is what Market Maker looks like if you haven't seen it. What's interesting for you if you are in a state that has it is it's a pretty easy way to find your population of grass-fed, not just beef producers, but anyone doing past grass-fed. There's a whole bunch of market screens I'm not taking you through. This was meant to show you that I had done the search already for pasture, grass-fed products, and that what it gave me was both a map of where those were in my state, and you can do this for all 18 states, it doesn't have to be just for your state, and then a listing of how to find them. Again, that might be useful for you guys if you're looking for partners. It might be useful for your producers if they want to get an idea of what the marketplace looks like. Go to other states and look how creatively or innovatively people are marketing their grass-fed in other states. But we got them to delineate even by production practice because we knew people oftentimes didn't even know where to start looking for what is going on in the market. So in summary, even though I went through very quickly and we can take questions, there does look like there's opportunities. All of our willingness to pay studies look like there are people willing to pay, but the economics only make sense if you follow a couple other conditions. You have to target just the consumers who find the benefits from grass-fed. Not that it shouldn't be a job for your producers to educate, but there are a lot of people out there educating and self-selecting to get educated, and you want to go for the low-hanging fruit when you're first trying to establish yourself in a marketplace. So target rather than going after the whole market. You have to have a production system that draws on resources that are already there, management expertise that's already there, and may integrate other practices of value to consumers and the farm or rancher themselves. And that the producer should go out and do due diligence, learn about all the certification programs, how they might align with grass-fed systems, and who their supply chain partners might be, and which of those certification programs they're interested in getting more product from as well. So hopefully that was relatively interesting for an economist. And I am willing to take questions, and sorry I covered so much in such a quick time, but there's a lot of economics to think about here. So, any questions, or is that your joke?
Do you have any questions for Dawn?
Well, that's easy.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, absolutely.
Dawn, with the different labels and all that that you have you looked at all what one is most distinguished by these consumers or, you know, anything about that? It seems like there's a lot of things now.
The problem with being an economist doing alternative stuff is I have to switch gears. So I did livestock about 8-10 years ago, and now I'm doing produce. So all I can talk about most currently is produce. And in produce, local right now is beating organic, which is great because everyone you work with has to be local to something. Now, if you're local in a not very consumer-dense market, that's a problem. But local goes as far as 300 miles, it looks like, in our studies. After that, actually, organic is losing a little bit of ground. Actually, fair trade programs are getting more leverage. And for you guys, the analogy for that would be the welfare of animal claims. I guess the problem for all of us as scientists is there's not a lot of science about what that actually means for outcomes. So the other thing we've started to look at is consumer psychology. And it looks like consumers are looking for claims where they actually have fairly credible proof of outcomes. And I think that's why local is getting a lot of ground, is because if you're actually meeting the producer, going to the ranch, you can see outcomes that they're still in business. You see how their animals are treated. You see what the property looks like. And organic seems like one degree of separation. Sometimes it's just as third party as general commodity markets. So I would say for you guys, what we really need is research on what some of these systems that are coming up actually means for outcomes. And the outcomes that seem to be most important to consumers right now are welfare of small family farms, but small actually can go up to about $1 million. We're not talking teeny tiny small. Environmental outcomes are actually losing a little bit of ground. Health outcomes are gaining ground. So the research we saw this morning is perfect, and I now know how to put that in my next survey. But does that make sense to everyone?
Yeah. Go ahead in the back.
As an economist, what you're doing is great. It'd be interesting to build a little bit more on what you're working on and draw out a little bit more of why people are buying particular products at extraordinarily high prices. You might want to look at California and even in Colorado, where you have a lot of cow shares, people have to search out the farmers and get their own milk. You'll see a 10x or 8x value added on even organic people buying raw milk, particularly because what we've identified is there's a direct, immediate response physiologically. People's bodies are measurable and shared by word of mouth. When your asthma goes away, wow. You know, that kind of thing going on with raw milk and probiotics and all the other goodies in there is shown in the European studies, but not really endorsed or supported by the FDA here nationally. It's a very interesting corollary between economics and immediate self-welfare in terms of personal health and the return back to the farm short of food chain. It's a very interesting dynamic, and I would ask that you look at that because it's really interesting in the next few years to see that developing because it's becoming bigger and bigger.
No, we work with Windsor Dairy. They're our big dairy that kind of led some of that movement. And the thing is there, I don't want the dairy mafia after me. I actually got uninvited to a project because they heard I was on something with Windsor. So there's some politics there, apparently. But I do agree that that is local food systems on steroids. When the CSA model and the cow shares and so forth. And we will probably look at it because it is... What I would say, and not to be disparaging of Europe, is we still do have fairly good consumer confidence in the USDA in this country. We did measure that with our last study on produce. They lost a bit in the last 5 years, and that's partly why we see people, we think, seeking out direct market relationships is because for the share, and it's only about, I think, 20% that are losing some faith in USDA and FDA and think there should be a different food police. What they're directly going to is direct markets. Almost all of them have shifted to, I'm just gonna buy on my own, know the person I'm working with, kind of this whole know your farmer, know your food. It's about 18 to 20% is what we're seeing in our studies. And for those of you working with grass-fed, that's again, all the market share grass-fed can handle right now anyway. So it's very much likely a pocket. Is that a good answer? Okay.
Since you mentioned the know your farmer, know your food, there's a round table.
Mark's here?
I haven't seen Mark.
Yeah, well, and I have to go back. I'm running. We have a beginning farmer program I'm going back to run, but if everybody else wants to make it, Mark would be a great resource because he's on that working group, I think, for USDA, right? So that's good to know about.
You have any other questions? Dennis?
What connection, or if there is any, between the income level of that person or their lack of better term, social class, and their notions
we did not see a strong of income effect as you'd expect. And where we did, it was those people I told you guys not to send your producers after anyway. They're a little particular, a little high maintenance, and they don't like frozen products. And for grass-fed, that's a reality. The urban conscious health-oriented parents were not as high income as you'd expect. They're certainly middle income at least. We also had a category up there I didn't even mention called empathetic value seekers. That was our way of saying there was people wanting to do the right thing but saying they couldn't afford to. With my particular beef group, they were having inventory problems because they move a lot of their middle meats and steaks and weren't moving. They had a lot of ground and roast on hand. Oh, I got them to just do a tiered pricing system. They make almost all the profits on their middle meats, and then they can price their ground and roast products, especially in value bundles, below their market price in their region, helps their inventory, and it allows them to feel ethical that they're not price gouging anybody who's just not particular about prices anyway, because the people buying middle meats in that region are the ones that are high income. So we've even tried to work with bundling of models where you can make it work for all income levels because there is some food justice issues with people. With milk, that's a little harder because it's all kind of the same milk and there's not an inventory problem as much, but they definitely do it with some of their value-added products. But that's what we did with beef, and it's not the income effect you guys would imagine. We always assume that'll pop out. We're really finding it's almost going away. It's across income levels, so.
Don, could you talk 1 minute about is our group here, we're mostly agronomists and livestock people. How can we incorporate economists and even social scientists into larger grants?
We're ornery. I know that. And I've been on a lot of panels for integrated projects where I'm sad about the lack of social science. I think, again, one thing, our pet peeve, and we have whole sessions about this at our meeting, is don't assume all we do is budgets, because budgets are really important. It's very important to know cost of production. But if you can engage the social scientists, and not just economists, but sociologists, and like we had a consumer psychologist on our last project, is talking about, and don't start the conversation with, well, consumers are ridiculous, but since they're light leading the market, we know we have to understand them. Try to engage us in a conversation about what do you think is the cutting edge things we need to understand about why the market's working like it's working, and get us on early enough that we actually can still frame it a little bit. Some of us will still be ornery, and I'm not disagreeing with that. And actually look for referrals. We all know who's easy to work with and who's not easy to work with. So get referrals from people, because not all economists or sociologists are created equal either. But know that we do more than production numbers, and know that we watch that we're good listeners. If we're not listening to you and you telling us what is the challenges to try to do forage systems well in your region, then don't work with us either, because if we're not good listeners, it's going to be a really long five-year project. But I'm just saying, allow us the flexibility to frame out for you what we think is interesting, but also know that if we're not listening back to you and listening to what you think are the guiding principles of what your science needs to look at, we may not be a good partner. Not all of us are. And get referrals from people. Not me, of course, because I would not want to say anything bad about anybody, but there are people who will talk freely about that. But I don't know if that's I don't know if that's a good advice at all, but I just want to be really vague, because I don't want to point out people who are
worried. One more question for Dawn before we go on to our next speaker.
Thanks for being a great audience.
Let's thank Dawn.